Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia.
Good morning.
We here at the Lodge offer this periodical. It's a quarterly periodical which enumerates the activities of the Lodge, which we'll get into in a little bit. Also offers some philosophical gems in each one of the periodicals. And in particular, we'd like to direct your attention to the back page, which has the Declaration of the Lodge. The Declaration is the sole guiding document of the United Lodge of Theosophists, a concise philosophical explanation, essentially, of who we are and what it takes if the movement interests you. We are a family of volunteer associates who are personally and collectively dedicated or devoted to the promulgation of the principles of ancient philosophy, which we call theosophy. The purpose of the Lodge is to serve as a venue whereby or wherefrom these principles are presented to the public in a non-sectarian format, to keep these ideas in their most universal sense before the public mind. This is done by a family of associates. It's not an organization. It's not a hierarchy of people with personal inclinations toward holding offices and things. There are no offices. There's no constitution. There are no bylaws. Rather, there is a simple declaration of the definition of the Lodge. Now, our work in the Lodge here, it's not to say that we don't have our procedures. Our work in the Lodge is to promulgate the principles of theosophy. Side issues and personal opinions on how people ought to view things or think, we don't have time for that. The time is devoted to the universal ideas and the consideration of preconceived ideas that we bring here to see how does it fit in, how true is the truth that I accept as true, and is there something more to it? Well, it's really all about inviting people to come consider universal ideas. So there's no charge for it. The door is open to all. There's no set condition on who can and who can't come. Everyone is welcome regardless of race, sex, condition, organization, etc. And really, the Lodge considers theosophists not just those who come to theosophical meetings, but anyone who lives to serve humanity, and anyone who chooses finds themselves in accord with these teachings are certainly welcome to participate and engender themselves as an associate in the Lodge. Now, our Lodge puts on meetings on a weekly basis and a monthly basis on Sundays. Every Sunday we have a meeting from 11 to 12, doors open at 10:30, And this month, for the month of February, our umbrella idea is theosophy that can be found in myths and allegories across time, religions, civilizations. The topic for next Sunday under this theosophy in myths and allegories, the topic for next Sunday will be the lessons of the zodiac. On Wednesdays, we have a study class, 7:45 to 9. We're studying the book called The Ocean of Theosophy, which is written by William Q. Judge, a collection of articles that were written in the 1890s, which form a synthesis of the theosophical philosophy. Also on Wednesdays, the doors actually open at 5:30. From 5:30 to 7:30, we have a reference library that's available where we come and we can read and prep for the Wednesday evening study class, and or you can use that time to use the materials to study for any line along philosophy, the arts, the sciences. You'll find a high-quality reference library in there in the light of theosophy. Furthermore, there's a desk in the foyer which is available before and after meetings to purchase theosophical literature if you feel so moved to study it at home. Everything for sale at this desk is at no profit. It's at the cost of the lodge guests that we provide it to the public. Then on a monthly basis, we have a third Friday of every month. We have this study of comparative philosophies and religions. And next month, March 19th, the third Friday of March, the topic is Psyche and Protocols, and Proteus. Psyche and Proteus. These 3 months, the umbrella topic for those meetings is reincarnation in myth and symbol. And this next presentation, March 19th, is Psyche and Proteus. Finally, we have an interlodge symposium scheduled for April 17th in the Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. If you care to get more information about that, you're welcome to talk to the people at the desk. So we also have our Theosophical Independence, which is a periodical which is written on a monthly basis by students of this lodge here in Philadelphia, which is free and available on the desk just outside the door as you leave. The activities of this lodge and the building itself are open to the public and they are free. There is no dues or subscriptions or fees. Anyone who chooses to offer in terms of time, service, or money is certainly welcome. All are gratefully received. And if you care to participate in such a way, you can speak to the person at the table after the meeting. Now, our topic for today is the hidden treasures in the Bible. This will be presented in a panel format. Two speakers will each spend between 5 and 10 minutes on certain topics, and then after the second one is finished, the rest of the meeting will be dedicated to questions and answers. The first talk will be dedicated to really what is this Adam thing all about? The anthropology, the generation of human beings as is taught in the Bible, and followed up with ideas of evolution that are found intrinsic to the Bible. And after that, and there'll be a few other things, then after that we will have a talk on the book of Job. So, when we read the Bible, there are those who read the Bible in the light of exactly how they're told to read it. And sometimes that might be inconsistent with the light that shined on the authors of it and what their intention was in terms of the message of the story. So, in spite of the education of lay people and of clergy, in spite of the growth of education over the millennia, still it seems that a lot of people in the Western world are of the opinion that Adam was formed out of clay by a God who decided to create a man one day and was finished with the whole earth in 7 days. There are other views of that, and we're going to consider some of those views. For instance, we've all heard of the fall of Adam, the fall in the Garden of Eden. Well, Theosophy tells us that this idea of the fall of Adam is really our fall, the fall of all mankind. Why is that? Because really the word Adam, as represented in the Jewish traditions, is a word that represents the human race or the human life wave. And so in the creation of Adam, or so to speak, the formation of Adam, or the synthesis of principles which eventually became the human being, this human being will go through cycles of incarnation and generation and regeneration, all to eventually evolve in certain ways, and then through his spiritual pilgrimage eventually reunite with the all. Now, the word Adam, meaning species of types, represents the archetypal or collective human idea. It's not one person. These allegories, if we look at the allegories of the Bible, really are replete with ideas of evolution, not necessarily with creation. For instance, the first race, we refer to a root race in Theosophy as a collectivity of human beings and the forms that they occupy at the time. Adam represents the root race. And in fact, there are four Adams in the Bible. The first is that the idea of the archetypal Adam. The first race is the archetypal or heavenly man. And the second is the androgynous Adam. We know that there was this Adam man before there was Adam and Eve. And it is said that Eve came out from the rib of Adam. Well, that Adam is all of humanity. That was the form. In that form are all of the principles. This is actually the second race. First, there was a more ethereal, spiritual race. Then the second race was an androgynous, sexless race. The third race is where we see the separation of the sexes. But if when we read this, that Eve was taken from Adam's rib, to interpret that literally as, and then the physical form was made, would be a mistake. Because that, theosophically interpreted, is the androgynous being polarizing itself from within. And so there's an Adam and Eve within the androgynous being. This is the third race. The next step will be that polarization manifests into the physical as physical male and physical females. This is known as we'll refer to it as the separation of the sexes in theosophical philosophy. And that is the beginning of, so to speak, of our journey on this earth when man, as a thinker, as an independent thinker, came onto the scene. Prior to that, the form was the human form, but without independent capacity to think, without what we call manus, the principle of mind. So those are some ideas that are right there in Genesis, if you read it in the light of Theosophy. But similarly, there is a, ready for this, there's a parallel parable in Genesis, and that's in Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel are also representative of evolution. And we can talk just a little bit more about that with the offerings, and one offering was accepted, the other was not, but we don't have time. If there are questions, we'd like to get into that. Then we'll refer to Seth, this interesting patriarch. Seth, in the fifth chapter of Genesis, refers to the genealogy of the patriarchs, 10 patriarchs. In that genealogy, Cain and Abel aren't even involved, even though they're, quote, the sons of Adam. Seth is the next patriarch. And he is the physical man who represents the third race, the end of the third race, the Lemurian race, when mind incarnated into man. So when we read the Bible, when we see Seth, That's the point of evolution where Adam and Eve actually were physical separate beings. And Seth is said to be the perfect man. The challenge at the time was to, in the course of evolution, to create the form in which these polarized ideas, the polarization of the being or the polarization of spirit, has a vehicle to synthesize itself again. So just as Adam was the spiritual archetype of man, so Seth is the physical archetype of man. It is said that he is the first perfect man, and that is the vehicle where which will serve as which will serve the opportunity to fully unite spirit and matter in the human being. So there's a lot there, but we can bring it out. Then there's this whole litany of what? Of biblical patriarchs that seem like a historical account of, you know, Lamech did this and Enoch did this and Enos did this. But each of these, so to speak, historical characters represent root races, sub-races, and family races in the evolution of humanity. When we read that, you know, Adam lived for 960 years and Methuselah lived for 970 years, the number of years that they lived was not granted by an outside God and said, well, this is my son and he'll live this long. Rather, those numbers are Kabbalistic symbols of Methuselah, who is not a person but a stage in the evolution of humanity. And apparently there's a lot to be learned if one takes the time to study the symbolism of it. We are not experts in Kabbalistic symbolism. We personally are not. Perhaps there's someone here who is. The line of, just to throw some names at you, the patriarchs. Many of us have heard Adam, Seth, Enos, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. Those are the patriarchs. And given our time constraint, we would say, we'll finish this up simply with Noah, and Noah's Ark is the story of the preservation of humanity from the fourth race, from the fourth sub-race of our present fifth root race, into the fifth root race, which is the current race that we're in, the fifth root race of humanity. The Ark has symbolism of the preservation of humanity, and there's a lot to be said about that if you have questions regarding. Can I go one more time?
Sure.
A little
sure,
bit more?
Sure.
It's okay? Okay. We found a very interesting example. When we look up these Jewish traditions, some of it is in the Bible, and it's very hard to really get an idea of what they're talking about, but there's commentary, there's Kabbalistic commentary on, that really shines a light on what's going on with the stories in the Bible. And one that we found, which was a really wonderful example of how the patriarchs represent the evolution of humanity, is as follows. It has to do with Enoch. He was one of the patriarchs, and he creates, here, just listen to the story. Enoch creates a subterranean temple consisting of seven chambers. In the lowest of these chambers, with the help of his son Methuselah, and so then his son would be perhaps the next sub-race after, so it wasn't done in a day, it was a process of evolution. With the help of his son Methuselah, who is also a patriarch, Enoch places a golden delta, whatever that means, a golden triangle, in the lowest part of the chamber, he places a golden delta with the secret name of God inscribed on it. Eventually, the site of this temple is lost. For a vast period of time, man sought in vain to find that secret subterranean room. At a later time, King Solomon comes along, who is represented as wisdom personified. If we want to think of what philosophically is Solomon, he's considered perhaps as universal wisdom personified. At a later time, King Solomon comes along and he resolves to build a temple on Mount Moriah. Solomon's workers, his workers, while building the temple and digging the foundation, discover that by wisdom, by the direction of wisdom, they are building this temple right on top of the sealed vaults of Enoch, wherein the Golden Delta is found. Solomon's temple, therefore, was built upon the same delta contrived by Enoch. So we'll leave it at that and pass the hat to you.
Okay. Well, so we see in one sense the hidden treasures of the Bible are scientific. They give us outlines in the allegories and myths of scientific explanations of the evolution of the race and other events in the course of humanity. But we're going to turn to the book of Job as an example of other kinds of treasures that can be found in the Bible. And of course, many people consider the Bible just full of treasures from page to page. So we choose the book of Job because of its timeless relevance. And we might say this way, that the book of Job attempts to answer the question, why do bad things happen to good people? It is the story of a righteous man who underwent the bitterest agony of body and spirit, and even though he was conscious of living an upright life, he nevertheless remained steadfast in his faith in the midst of all his affliction. And at the end of the story, he is ultimately granted a happier life than he had before. So that's the basic story, and we're familiar with it because it's been repeated through the years in many plays and novels and so forth. It's one of those archetypal stories. Now, HPB has indicated that this story, this work, is one of the oldest works in the Hebrew Bible, but it is generally misunderstood because it is an allegory that echoes the teachings of the ancient wisdom religion. And we have to understand that the use of allegories and myths by the ancients was not just for the story that it gave, but it hid within it, as we can see, scientific information, philosophical information, ethical, moral, psychological teachings as well. So the book of Job, then, is an allegory on the poem on initiation. It is a record of the Egyptian mysteries or hidden wisdom and initiation. And it is a complete representation in this poetical allegorical form of the ancient initiatory rites and trials which preceded them. Just as the Book of the Dead and the various images we see in the pyramids are allegorical representations of these same mysteries and teachings carved in stone and manuscript. So it is an allegory, we might say, on karma and its purification. And we might say at one level, the universal message for us that we can take home is that suffering is not always the result of evil or something that we've done wrong. It's not always a punishment. Because suffering is also the great purifier and initiator into wisdom. It has been said that woe unto him who hasn't suffered. Suffering brings us strength, it brings us compassion, it brings us discipline and self-reliance. So in many ways, suffering is a valuable learning experience. So as we open this book of Job in the very first sentence, we are introduced to Job this way. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. This man was the greatest of all the men in the East. So this is not a common character. This is one who was the greatest man in the East, and already a virtuous man, and had very great wealth, very great fame, health, and family. Of course, he lost all these things in the course of his trials. Now, the Kabbalah tells us that the Hebrew name for Job is Bo-Yah, coming from the root meaning to come back, thus describing one who comes back or returns to God, one who is trying to self-consciously realize and return to that divine source within themselves to gain full knowledge of it. So this is not just a story of good and evil and happiness and suffering. It's a story of ignorance versus wisdom. So being good is not the whole point. It's also important to be wise and have wisdom. So at some point in this process of initiation, as performed in the various mystery schools in ancient times, the teacher or the initiator would descend into the crypt or the cave where the disciple was being tested and would assist the candidate. Now, prior to this point in this story where Job meets his initiator, he's suffered and he has friends who come to him and they mean well. And basically their message to his through him through many arguments is, look, you have to be in this condition because something you've done wrong. You've offended God, you've performed some evil. And he rejects them outright. He said, no, I revere. I'm a good man and I've done all these things. And he says, you know, I reject what you say. You do not give me true wisdom. And he asks, well, where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? It is not in the world, and it cannot be bought. So at this point, when the disciple no longer looks outside himself or herself for knowledge, but begins to search within, we might say, or try to find where real wisdom is, and then he meets the teacher. As it is said, when the disciple is ready, the teacher will appear. And so Elihu, his fourth friend, is this hierophant, this perfected teacher, the inspired philosopher. And in chapter 33, Elihu tells Job that he will teach him wisdom. And he says there are two sources of wisdom, the way it, real wisdom, the way it descends upon him, upon man. And in chapter 32, he says, there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the divine giveth man this wisdom through that spirit, through this spirit that man gains understanding. And what is this spirit in man? Well, in the book of Job, the term is used, wisdom is with the ancient. And theosophy and the Kabbalah tell us that the Ancient of Days, is a representation of that universal wisdom and also the way it is particularized in our higher mind. Not our lower everyday personal mind, but that higher mind that is more intuitional. So the other way in which we gain wisdom, it is said by Elihu, the teacher, is that in dreams and visions of the night, man is instructed. So we read in the book of Job, in a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men in slumberings upon the bed, then he opens the ears of men and sealeth their instruction. And so we know that real dreams are, as opposed to fanciful and allegorical dreams, are true visions of the night in which many things come to us, not just inventions, but also inspiration and solutions to our problems. Now, the book of Job is one of those clear examples, whether we're looking at it from the point of view of the Kabbalah or theosophy, or just looking at the text itself as it survives from the King James Version, where theosophy says that the teaching of reincarnation still survives and is present in the Bible. Now, Elihu teaches Job about reincarnation. We can find it in chapter 33. And it says there, behold, all these things does God do twice, even three times with a man. to bring his soul back from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of the living. The idea being that the ego, the soul, has to return sometimes two or three times to learn the lessons that are necessary to gain wisdom, to become stronger. So the purpose of the reincarnation as taught in Job, Book of Job, is for the purification and enlightenment through experience in a body. Now, we might say, well, that's a bit of a stretch. Maybe something else was meant. But if we look at the rest of the book, it's very clear that the idea of reincarnation was very prevalent at that time, and Job was aware of it. It was a common doctrine taught at that point, because Job says in the first chapter, "Naked I left my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there." Now, this is the greatest man in the East. There is no way a naked man can return to his mother's womb, unless he's speaking allegorically of the process of himself as a soul being born in one mother's womb, and at another point he returns and comes back in life through another mother's womb. "Naked I left my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there." In other words, naked of this physical form. But he goes on to say, there in chapter 14, there's this allegory of the tree. And it very much teaches this idea of reincarnation. "For there is hope of a tree, if it be out, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and the tender branch thereof will not cease, though the root thereof wax old in the earth, and the stock thereof die in the ground, yet through the scent of water it will bud and bring forth boughs like a plant." And right after that, he says, "If a man die, shall he live again?" That's a very astounding statement. There, it is very clear there. They were debating at the time reincarnation. And what does he say in the context of this story about the tree? "All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change comes." The idea of the process of evolution and change over time through many lives. Now, there are other lessons in there about the nature of God, the symbolism of God, the idea that the God as taught in the Book of Job is not the outside personal anthropomorphic God, but more along the lines of the universal principle represented by motion, by thought of our minds as space and motion and source of all life. And at the end, not only of the story, not only does Job gain wisdom, not just hearing about wisdom, but direct personal experience of the operation of the divine laws in nature, or what we call theosophy, but he also has restored to him all his former wealth and fame and family. So we'll stop here and invite your questions and comments on these two presentations.
Yes.
Well, it was mentioned that suffering is the great purifier. But Buddha taught, or perhaps he taught the same thing, but put it in a different way, that life is suffering, and that we are to look for the cessation of suffering, or to stop it. Is that different in philosophy or ideas, or is it the same idea?
So Buddha taught that there were four truths about life. And the first truth we can't escape is that life is full of suffering. How can we reconcile that with suffering is a great purifier and teacher? Well, it's only a purifier and teacher if we bring the right attitude to it, the right knowledge to it. If we begin to look at ourselves as a victim or blame others, it's not a purifier and a teacher. So Buddha goes on to explain what the cause of suffering is, and that you have to cease that suffering by following a certain path. If we want to get, and then he gives the path of purification and discipline and self-reliance, we call the Eightfold Path. So it is the same teaching there as we find in the Book of Job.
And this suffering that we're talking about applies to the idea of Cain and Abel, where Cain and Abel present gifts to the Lord, and Abel presents the firstlings of his flock, as said in the Jewish tradition. Cain offers the fruits of the ground. Abel's firstling of his flock is accepted, and Cain's is not. Why is that? Because the firstlings of his flock is explained as, we've heard of the burnt offerings, and we've heard that the ancient Jewish people would burn a cow or burn a bull in sacrifice to God. Really, that's an outward and exoteric representation of sacrificing our own personal lower tendencies, our own personal emotional needs to, sacrificing the impermanent aspect of us to the permanent, so dedicating ourselves to higher principles. What Cain offered was the fruits of his work. The fruits of his work, or the fruits of his actions. What Abel offered was really himself, and by offering himself, which is suffering, which is sacrifice, which in essence we interpret it as Raja Yoga, the transmutation of self to the higher. That's the sacrifice that is expected for evolution. And for this reason, Cain got jealous of Abel, and then we all know the story how Cain murdered Abel. Yes?
Yes. You say Job is a book of initiation, but Revelation is also a book of initiation. What if they're combined in one person?
Mm-hmm. What if they're combined in one person? Well, it's a very good point. We were hoping to be able to present the book of Job and Revelation. But we found we didn't have enough time. But you're absolutely right. The book of Enoch is a book of initiation. And the Revelations, especially in chapter 12, is a book of initiation. What we find is these same stories appearing in different traditions. And there are many things that are taught. You had some example of the book of Enoch. Enoch has a vision. And in his vision, he sees a tremendous warfare between the divine and the chaotic principles in life. And most of mankind follows the chaotic principles and are destroyed. And at the end, everything is restored in harmony and in balance. The same story appears in John's book of Revelations. Different symbolism, different tradition, adapted to a different culture and religion. But the very symbols that are used, the very names of the symbols that are used, are very similar. So it is representative not of one person, but of one kind of person. Just as the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna there represents one kind of person, that individual of whatever race, creed, sex, condition, organization, time, place, is beginning to understand that a certain kind of life will not bring them the happiness, the wisdom, the results they want, and begins the struggle, the purification, the initiation into true self-knowledge. So we see that story throughout the world.
And what's interesting we find about these stories in the Old Testament is we need to try to not make the mistake of thinking that if it comes first in the Old Testament, then it historically happened before what came next. Rather, there are so many stories so replete symbolically with universal ideas that it's more a cyclical representation of the same ideas in many, many stories, especially as regards to evolution. For instance, Noah, who is represented as the first of the current fifth subrace, has so much in common with Adam. For instance, Adam ate of the forbidden fruit. Noah drank the wine of the fruit, and this was forbidden by the law. Second, both of them eventually became aware of their nakedness. Adam did when God, when he realized that God knew that he had eaten of the fruit, and Noah did when he woke up from his drunken stupor. They both realized they were naked, so that must have some kind of symbolic interpretation. And then also, both Adam and Noah had three sons, and those sons were charged with repopulating, either populating or repopulating a, so to speak, empty earth after the flood and in the beginning of the earth. So there are parallels there which would have correspondences, yes? Was there a follow-up?
No, I think there was a question.
I'm sorry. There was a question. Yes, ma'am.
Did you have
you had a question? Yes.
Is there a story about Seth where I believe the elders had went to his father in order for them to teach him and train him, you know, to more or less get elevated with knowledge, and the father objected to it, so Seth went back to the family, and that's where that community fell. Is there some truth to that?
We don't recall any particulars of that, do you?
We're not familiar with that story, but are you saying that Seth went to the...
No, one of the elders.
Yes.
Went to his father to take him, to teach him, and to train him. Because more than likely, you know, we have children, you know, we, you know, want our children to be very, very knowledgeable, and there's always somebody else that can teach them something that we don't know. And this didn't happen with that community. Does that have anything to do with
We didn't come across that in our studies.
There's probably a lot more into it.
Yes. Well, there's this teaching in the East of what they call the Guru Parampara chain. And the idea is that there's a transmission of knowledge, just like the light. Oh, we just had the Olympics, okay, or in the process of the Olympics. And you know how the torch is carried across many, many miles through a series of torchbearers. And finally, we have the light. If you think light as a symbol of wisdom, that same wisdom is transmitted not only in cross time by a brotherhood or a sisterhood or a collectivity of wise human beings, but it can also be transmitted from the highest to the lowest under karma, from the teacher to our teachers in schools to our parents. So we may learn the lessons. And if under certain circumstances we don't get the lesson from our parents, whether they're our natural parents or adoptive parents, we might get it from a friend, we might get it from a school teacher, we might be inspired, we may get it from someone we meet in the street. There's this, life is a school. And one of the ways we learn is through suffering. If we learn through happiness, a lot of us would be a lot further along than we are. We tend to take our happiness for granted and only begin to question ourselves in life when we suffer. And so life is a school, and many of the opportunities we have and the people we meet are our teachers if we learn to listen, pay attention.
Yes.
So in line with that and what was said previously, when the fruit or the knowledge is eaten or we become aware in several different places, what was said. Perhaps the awareness of the nakedness is our realizing now with knowledge how we have acted, what we have done, what we have thought and felt, and how we could have better done. And so it's sort of that's sort of turning on the light bulb for that moment, the awareness coming and not being able to go back to ignorance. So perhaps that awareness of the nakedness is something like that.
So the contribution has to do with the lighting up of mind, whether it's in the course of human evolution or one day in the life of John Doe, he wakes up and realizes, you know what? I am a brother of all humanity, and this life I've been leading is inconsistent with what I know my conscience is telling me the right thing to do. And once he learns and puts certain principles in action, you can't undo that. Once one has the light of mind or the light of philosophy, to put it to the side and ignore it, it can't go away. Is that the idea that you're putting forth in the blue?
Well, it's just interesting that one of the most common nightmares is of thinking that you are naked. in front of a crowd of people who are completely dressed, and we think that might be a kind of internal awakening or initiation that there's a problem somewhere.
Mm-hmm. We have the expression, the naked truth. So what is it that hides us or makes us blind to the naked truth of our being? Is it not layers and layers of misconceptions, of blind spots, of prejudices about ourselves and others? And until those are stripped away, we might even say burned away by trial and suffering, until that is burned away, do we get to the bottom of who and what we really are? And when we face the naked truth, it can be of ourselves, it can be the most terrifying thing in the world. And so we can see in that stage, it can come at the very lowest point of our life, just as there's given examples in the story of Noah there. But when it comes, the realization, there's that choice that has to be made. Okay, I've reached the bottom. Now where am I going to go? Now that I learned the truth, am I going to go higher towards the divine, or am I just going to sink and stay here? So all those stories tell the same human condition.
This has a parallel to the story of the Jews and their experiences in Egypt, where in Egypt they were, now allegorically speaking, in Egypt where they were enslaved, and they accepted or knew that they were slaves, but when they made the decision, no, this is not where we are going to stay, their procedure through the desert for so long is really the pilgrim's journey through a desert of hope and despair. And it's a journey, sure, eventually to the promised lands, but there are all sorts of trials that they're going to go through as a people. So allegorically, this is the story of Exodus, is the story of awakening consciousness from the slave, which we are not, to the promised land. Yes? With the black?
You keep on using this word allegory.
Allegory, you sure?
Allegory. And that you see that you've read something in the Bible that we've read many, many times, and you see something different than what we originally saw. Is there a key to understanding an allegory that will perhaps make it a way for us to look at these stories or these writings and get a glimpse of what the truth is?
So the question is, what is the key to understanding the message in the allegory? Well, there are a number of keys. Depending on how allegories are written and how they're interpreted, you know, they can be interpreted, the great allegories can be interpreted cosmologically, they can be interpreted psychologically, theologically, all depending on the angle that where, if the truth is a diamond, are we looking at one facet of the diamond, or are we able to look at the entire diamond and synthesize all facets of the diamond? That's the invitation. So, in essence, really, these allegories, unfortunately, are lost in certain ways by modern man who views them as just stories and doesn't value them and values more what literally happened at a certain point in time. And if it's history, it's true. If I can prove that it didn't historically happen, then that invalidates it. When actually, if it's history, who cares? What matters is, what is the universal truth in the scriptural story? And let's not mistake the story as the truth. You know, the story of the life of whatever prophet you pick is nowhere near as valuable as the truths that this prophet is learning and living as he proceeds through life. Because if it is Holy Scripture, if it has the universal ideas, those universal ideas are going to correspond to the individual as he studies and reflects on the ideas of the allegories. Does that make sense? So what is it? What do the allegories really mean? depends on who you are and where you are in life and how much effort we put into it, there can be a lot of different interpretations and meanings to it. Yes.
It brought back to mind what is referred to as the Negro National Anthem. The wording sometimes escapes us, but something said on the platform this morning, in the anthem it says, drunk with the wine of the world, lest we forget thee, drunk with the wine of the world. And we mentioned something about Seth, one of the characters, being in a drunken stupor or something. Can you remember?
Noah.
Oh, it's Noah.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that we become drunk with the wine of the world?
How is it that we become drunk with the wine of the world? Our understanding is Noah becoming intoxicated with the fruit of the vine is related to humans generally who identify themselves with this form and these emotions and these false ideas to the point that they forget really who they are, that they are ultimately, behind all of it, the archetypal Adam, which is the image of, so to speak, God or deity. As we proceed through evolution, we don't leave these principles behind. They are everything we ever were is still inherent to us. Consciously, what are we aware of, though? Do we identify with our outer impulses, or do we maintain that long, silent, stable sense of I, the observer, am experiencing and learning and growing in wisdom, and the object, of course, being to learn and assimilate the lessons that are being taught. Then behind, there was a lady in the purple who had a hand up.
The reference about partaking of the fruit of knowledge, and Adam, when God calls him, suddenly realizes the nakedness. Can you also maybe equate this feeling of nakedness to suddenly realizing this ignorance? That he partakes of the fruit of the knowledge and suddenly realizes, I know nothing. It's like, I think it's Socrates who said that the more I know, the more I learn, the less I know. I know.
Thank you. So the suggestion is that the eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge is Adam realizing his own ignorance. So in a certain way, that could be an initiation in itself. What a wonderful thing finally to realize that you're not all that in a bag of potato chips when you look back. And at least you know you have a starting point to work from. Was there a hand down? Yes, in the blue.
Well, isn't that the whole secret of the process? As thinkers, it's involution first. We have to come and get involved in matter, in lower personality, in order to have the contrast and then realize we are not that. We are spirit. So, in a certain sense, we're blameless for drinking of the fruit of the vine, but it's the fact that we don't want to stop that's the problem, and we've lost our contact with that spirituality.
Thank you. So the contribution here is the fall of Adam is not the sin. Perhaps the sin is that once Adam has fallen, he chooses not to get back up again when he realizes where he is. Yes? Oh, sorry.
We wanted to say the fruit of the vine symbolism it appears throughout the Bible, and there are several expressions that give a clear indication of what it means. If you think of the grapes growing on the vine, it's a single stalk, and you have these bunches coming off. So the vine there represents the immortal ego, and the grapes or the fruit of the vine represent the personalities, that sort of bud off and blossom. They have their life and they die off. So intoxication with the fruit of the vine is when we get intoxicated with or lose ourselves entirely in the personal life and forget the vine or the root from which we've come.
Yes.
Well, this is a double-edged question. The first part is...
You can answer it.
Sorry?
Go ahead. He'll answer it then.
No, no. Okay. A double-edged question.
That's really two questions in one. The first part was there in the allegories and the metaphors of what was just stated, that there's reference to reincarnation and karma, etc. So how come it's not overtly taught today in the major religions of today? And then what is reincarnation and karma anyway?
What is reincarnation and...
karma, anyways, that's the second part of the question.
Yeah. Well, why is it not... outwardly taught reincarnation and karma in the world's religions? Well, it is outwardly taught in the world's religions. It's not outwardly taught in some religions, particularly in the West. And so we can answer that question perhaps by understanding what reincarnation ultimately and karma ultimately are. They are the doctrine of hope and responsibility. Who wants to keep hope and responsibility away from us? Just think about it. If we are entitled, if our birthright as human beings on this plane, if we are divine in essence and our manifestations of our higher nature on this plane to perform a definite purpose, who wants to keep hope and responsibility away from us? Enslaved in ignorance, of who and what we are, keep us on a path. And why do they want to keep us away from that? And we think if we are fair and observers of our life, whenever we look at those who have an invested interest in power over another, whether it's temporal power, religious power, wealth, that's the technique to drive somebody down into a state of hopelessness and sinfulness and helplessness, that they have no hope, they have no responsibility other than to rely on those who set themselves up in a position of power. Now, one does not have to be a student of philosophy to realize that. One just needs to be an observer of life, both their own life and the life of people they care about, to realize that truth.
So, I'm sorry.
So what is reincarnation and karma?
So it's reincarnation and karma, but then you said it is outwardly taught.
Well, it's outwardly taught in, for example, many of the Eastern religions. It's outwardly taught now in the Kabbalah, and there are certain mystical aspects of Christianity in the popularization now of Gnosticism, the esoteric aspects of Christianity, where it's clearly taught. So it's there. And we even see, in spite of the fact that it's not outwardly taught, at least 25% of adult people in the Americas, in the United States, believe in reincarnation, even though they're from another religious persuasion. And they incorporate these ideas right into their own beliefs. And another 25% aren't sure, which is interesting. They're thinking about it.
Dave's in the corner.
So the initiation example that was touched on with the temple that was built underground with the seven rooms and then the gold triangle, are we looking that might be an analogy for the seven principles of man? And it was stated specifically that the gold triangle was put in the lowest. Is that, and then when we're looking at initiation, is that the lighting up of mind then?
As we read that, and that was the first time we'd ever read that, we interpreted it as... we're not sure how the lighting up fits in, but that it was put in the lowest, we interpreted that as in the deepest, in the center of the nature. And of course, the temple that was built, or these caverns that were dug and created, we think represents the human form. And deep within the human form was placed this golden triangle inscribed on which is the sacred name of God. And that form eventually was disintegrated and gone, and men lost, you know, wherever that triangle was. But through Solomon, by building Solomon's temple, Solomon being the personification of wisdom, by living wisely, man began to rebuild that form. And as he found out, as much as he had been looking for that golden triangle, where he built that temple, because he did it wisely, he built it right on top of the golden triangle and found it.
Yes. It's clear from the Bible that the building of Solomon's temple is an allegory, because it says there that it was a temple built without a sound being heard, which is impossible. Unless we understand it to be the silent process of evolution and the building of the form of man. The temple has always been a symbol of the physical body being the principle, the outward manifestation of the divine inner man within, the divine thinker. So in the Book of Enoch, we have the inner departments, the sevenfold principles of man's nature, where at the very center we have the golden triangle, the triangle always being symbolic of the deity. And its outer manifestation, as above, so below, rebuilt right on top of it, upside down, we might say, being the outer temple of Solomon's, the physical form. So we really, next week, we'll continue in this investigation, this exploration of symbolism and allegory by going to the what we learn, the messages, the lessons from the zodiac. And also to remind you that beginning this Wednesday, starting this Wednesday in the Ocean of Theosophy, we'll take up the subject of karma. Our meeting is adjourned.
Just made it nicely. Yeah. Huh? Oh, yeah, it folded in, didn't it?
Yeah,
they
moved it, yeah. Okay. So I didn't see any fingers go up or any hands.